On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
One of the reasons I'm really interested in it is because we have to find these good uses for it, for education and training, before everyone uses it to become worse people. I've realized how upside down this world is more and more in the past couple of years. There's always a way to adapt, but you have to honor that sometimes it's time to stop doing things.
We're both on Greatest in the world's 100 most influential health and fitness people, and we're not there anymore.
Try to look us up.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Well, I've been put to shame. My guest on today's podcast has a much better, deeper, richer podcasting voice than I do. And he's also a wonderful musician, a Renaissance man, a dear friend, a man after my own heart, the great Abel James. We had a fun conversation you're going to love. Well, folks, my guest on today's podcast is an old friend of mine, meaning he's not old. He's just young and vibrant, but he's been my friend for a long enough time to where I would call him an old friend. He's also a New York Times bestselling author. He is a musician. He is the host of a podcast, a very popular podcast called The Fat Burning Man Show, which has been a number one podcast multiple times in the health category of Apple and beyond, all over the planet for quite some time. So he's also a little bit old school in that regard, I suppose. He and I, way back in the day, put together a course on Udemy. What was that course even about, Abel, before I finish introducing you? I'm now forgetting.
It was kind of like biohacking before biohacking a little bit, before people knew what it was. So it was just Greenfield showing off all of his cool gizmos and me being a slack jaw to some of the other people who are watching.
Yeah, it was basically, I don't even know if it's still on Udemy. It probably is. It would be entertaining to go back and watch it and see what we were excited about then. Totally. You know, I think you had all sorts of crazy things. You were roasting your own coffee. I remember you wouldn't shut up about like how proud you were that you were roasting your own coffee.
And so good.
You decoded green coffee beans. And I think I had gotten my first ever like device that I could put on my head. I think it was like a V light or something like that. And I was super proud that I was using cutting edge science to stick some probe up my nose. And you were concerned, I think, about damage to my brain. And yeah, it was back in the early days. And so, anyways, to continue on with the introduction, although I've kind of spoiled it now, Abel James is my guest. He has been named as one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness. He has been an influencer in the health and fitness community, particularly amongst kind of the ancestral paleo-ish crowd for quite some time. And he's really a dynamic personality, as you'll learn on today's show, because he is a bit of a Renaissance man. I don't know if I'm going to go so far as to call you a polymath, Abel, but I would say a Renaissance
only
man.
Only if you call yourself one, Ben.
Yeah, exactly.
Call you one. You can call me one.
I don't even know what polymath means, honestly. So I'm pretty sure that automatically classifies me as not being a polymath. However, Abel just sent me up his book, a new book on poetry that he wrote, and then an updated version of his new award-winning book, The Wild Diet, which is also a little bit of a fitness manual in and of itself as well. And of course, he's also a fantastic musician. Are you on Spotify, Abel? Can people find you there?
Yeah, look up Abel James on Spotify.
Okay. All right, cool. And I'll link to Abel, his website, his music, his books, everything, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies. And why designer babies? Because the name of Abel's book that he sent to me a few weeks ago that my kids got a real kick of, actually. They thumbed through it for like a good hour at the dinner table. I got lots of questions from this book. It's called Designer Babies Still Get Scabies. It's a poetry book. And so I not only want to talk a little bit about how a guy so immersed in health and fitness gets into poetry and also marries that to music, but a whole lot more, because Abel has some great stories. So welcome back to the show, man.
Thanks so much, Ben. And I just want to say it's been, like a decade now. I think you actually first got in touch with me kind of like blind. I didn't know who you were at the time for music. So it's so cool to, you know, 10 years later, kind of with everything that's happened.
Yeah, I remember actually. you were interested in, or I knew that you were interested in music and its correlation to the brain, something I was interested in at the time too, how music can expand and grow the brain. You and I met online, and then we went to like this back alley San Francisco conference with like maybe a couple of dozen people in some basement of like a co-working space or something like that in San Francisco, put on by this random dude who was kind of getting into putting on conferences named Dave Asprey. And it was Dave Asprey's little biohacking conference. It was like me, you, Aubrey Marcus. I'm trying to remember who else, like just a few of kind of like the folks who have since gone on and kind of launched their own little I guess everything from biohacking to fitness to nutrition communities. It was kind of funny. That's where you and I think actually met face to face, because you were giving a talk about music and the brain.
Yeah. And then after that, then the ancestral health conferences and then, you know, masterminds and all this stuff, we were seeing each other everywhere for a while. And then, you know, times kind of change, and like you always expect, or at least I expect things to go on forever as they are. That's something we need to work around, I think.
Yeah.
So now it's been, especially with these lockdowns, so much harder to see people like you, Ben, give proper hugs and, you know, like actually mastermind, you know, like really talk to each other, especially for dudes, for women too, but for dudes, we need that excuse. And so that's been interesting, because as you referenced, I've unplugged with my wife a few times, and we've kind of been on the circuit and then off the circuit, and I miss you, man. I miss a lot of the people who we used to get together with. Hopefully we can bring a lot of that back.
I miss you too. Well, you got married too, which of course throws a wrench into hanging out with the bros. You got married to like a competitive video game athlete, didn't you?
Yeah. So Allison was one of the first, she was on one of the first all pro, all female video gaming teams. And she specialized in first person shooters like Halo. So now she pretty much runs our business, and that's she made a good transition there.
That's crazy. And I, from what I understand, that can actually be a very successful career, e-gaming.
Totally.
I was even reading an article the other day about how doping is becoming an issue, like, you know, modafinil and microdosing with psychedelics, you know, or you know, using LSD, et cetera, that they're actually concerned or beginning to somehow do some type of testing for e-gaming. And there was another sport, I think it was like chess or something like that, at universities that they were also beginning to test for, because doping, not like, you know, blood doping with erythropoietin, but psychedelic or nootropic or smart drug dosing is increasingly common amongst them and poker players as well.
Yeah, even just Adderall. And that was actually big back in the day. I remember going to college. I was very much against drugs. I had an older brother who was for drugs. And so I was kind of raised with that as a negative example, and really stayed away from especially hard drugs and Adderall and study drugs and things like that. But in gaming, in universities, in a lot of sports, people are going to try to do whatever they can. And it's, you know, Allison talked about this, how it's like, try to compete playing video games against someone who's on Adderall, who's just been crushing for 14 hours straight, like in the zone. And they might win the video game short term, but then they're not going to be a health person after that.
The game of life can get a little bit effed up with enough amphetamine and dextroamphetamine combined with long periods of time staring at screens, I can imagine.
Yeah, not good. But I mean, to your point, it's incredible, because now, especially in this crazy world we're living in now, I would not expect, you know, physical sports to outlast the esports for very much longer. And you're seeing the esports really starting to overtake the physical sports, which is, it kind of messes with my head a little bit. I don't know if it's good or bad. It's different though.
Yeah. I actually didn't know that it was outpacing, although with the way the NBA is progressing, you know, indoor arena games televised with no crowds, and UFC fights in Abu Dhabi with no screaming participants in the audience, I can imagine that group crowd sports, the way that we're used to viewing them, well, they have changed, and we'll see how long this lockdown continues. But I would imagine people would be able to increasingly, or with greater ease, turn to e-gaming. So that wouldn't surprise me.
One thing that we have gotten really into in the past few years is virtual reality. And that has been used and can be used for training purposes. Quarterbacks have been using this for many years. And the Ben, have you tried it much? You probably have, right?
Yeah, I've tried virtual reality in that I've gone to the virtual reality movie theater in LA at Century City, where you're immersed in your own kind of 20-minute movie that you're a part of. I've attended Peter Diamandis's A360 event, which yep. basically was a huge collection of different VR haptic vests, haptic gloves, and pretty cool experience, I think, for some. Although I just between that and my other VR experiences, for example, taking my kids every single freaking day to the arcade in Dubai when I brought them there because all they wanted to do was go to VR. I just have something that slightly twists in my stomach when I have a giant device attached to my head generating electricity indoors in stale air, trying to live a life on a screen when I could otherwise be experiencing something outdoors that is real. And I get it. Like, I had dinner with Andrew Huberman a few months ago in LA, and he was talking to me about his neurology lab at Stanford, where he's using virtual reality to cure fear. He's putting in people mm-hmm. down swimming with great white sharks and jumping off cliffs. And I see that as a good application. I see training surgeons, you know, to do VR surgery as a good application. But I see the cons outweighing the pros, at least for me, mm-hmm. of VR for pure entertainment's sake.
Totally. And I hear that. And we've been kind of playing with it, and we've had at least a half dozen different headsets, some of them tethered to powerful computers and things like that. And when you have the 6 degrees of freedom, which you probably had in Dubai and some of the more, you know, if you go to a place that has virtual reality, most of them have kind of room scale where you can walk around and it's changing with you. But what I wanted to bring up that's really interesting was the fact that if there's, even if it's just a visual image up against you, like a boxer or someone coming at you in virtual reality, it feels viscerally real.
It does. I did the boxing game. And another one was, you know what my very first experience was I was with author Neil Strauss, and he had just gotten the Oculus Rift, and he was super stoked about it. He was showing me the dinosaur game, and when the T-Rex came at me and lunged at me, I felt its saliva spray in my face. Right. I'm like, holy shit, this is real. I don't know how I felt that sensation. And I finished and I removed the headset, and he was standing there smiling with a little water squirt bottle, and because he had sprayed my face right when the T-Rex had lunged. Awesome. So I was a little bit confused about what was going on, but yeah, it can be incredibly realistic. And I'm curious what kind of device that you experiment with. I would imagine, you know, being married to Allison, you guys probably have access to some of the top notch stuff, or at least you know what's top notch.
Yeah, we've dabbled. The one that's like the highest quality that we've used is the HTC Vive. I think ours mm-hmm. is the Pro. There are okay. so many different permutations, but we have the untethered Oculus, the cheaper variety headsets, a couple of those. And those don't have the 6 degrees of freedom room scale thing. And so what that means is you can turn your head and the scene will change and you can look around. But if you move your head like up and down, if you crouch, if you walk forward, it's not going to change accordingly. And that, I believe okay. it's that really makes it feel realistic for people, or at least for me. And that's when you can, you know, it's so funny when I started playing some of these boxing games and some of these target practice or archery games and things like that, I wondered how useful the training would be. Are we training bad habits and whatever? But before I could even think about any of that, there's someone up on you, like trying to punch you in the face, and I'm dodging it, and I'm crouching down, and I'm sweating as if I'm actually sparring with someone. You know how you're totally gassed after like 90 seconds, two minutes, whatever. I got that out of one of the first times I ever used like a boxing VR game in the 6 degrees of freedom. And I found that extremely powerful because, yes, it can be used for good, but more likely it's going to be used to, you know, control people more or make them buy more stuff or subtly influence the way that their mind works or their brain patterns. And also, to your point, all of the, you know, EMFs and the lights and staring into lamps is not good for you. So it's definitely, there are growing pains right now, but I think one of the reasons I'm really interested in it is because we have to find these good uses for it, for education and training, before everyone uses it to become worse people.
Yeah, yeah, and apparently, I was reading an article, and I'll hunt it down and link to it in the show notes. There are some people now combining, you know, LSD, mushrooms, MDMA, etc., with some of these virtual reality experiences to enhance the psychedelic experience.
That sounds like a CIA wet dream, like MK Ultra and steroids.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, having experienced plant medicines in the context of really good music, you know, mindfold mask, or even in some cases some light therapy devices, I could actually see that being pretty interesting, or at least, if nothing else, a fantastic experience. Although I haven't ever experienced something like that personally, I think that would be very interesting. You know, the combination of psychedelics and virtual reality.
Yeah, I think it's just you have to be careful, right? Because like when you read a tweet, there's not that much data exchange between people. When you throw on a headset though, and you put yourself in that environment, you're gonna have dreams about it. It's that real. Yeah. So especially for kids, before we normalize all of this, I think we want to be careful with it. One thing that really impressed me with the state of the technology is the cameras are a bit better than the headsets right now. And the resolution is ahead of it by a few years, it seems. And so I went to my brother's farm up in upstate New York, and he has bees and he's growing all these different things. And because of the resolution, you can get right up in there. And so I filmed a lot of 360 from the beehive, and also kind of like explaining how he grows things and looking up closely in the soil. You just can't really do that so well with an iPhone video as you can in VR with a high rate of resolution and a refresh rate that's appropriate and good color and all the rest of it. So there's definitely a learning curve, and it's freaking 2 to 4 gigabytes. 2 to 4 gigabytes a minute, I think, for that footage in particular.
Have you put any of that online? Any of like the filming that you've done for virtual reality experiences?
Yeah, I put some, and actually a couple of years ago, we were like some of the top creators on some of those sites, but because it's such a new and expensive area, a lot of these companies and platforms just come and go. So like for us, we have a ton, we have over 400 or 500 VR experiences that we've created, but most of them are on hard drives because there isn't that, like we threw some of them up there on Vimeo, but that doesn't have spatial audio. The audio doesn't sync up perfectly with, you know, the footage because they don't have the tech there. And then YouTube does, but they don't pump any of your videos and they don't show them to anyone because people aren't wearing the headsets yet. So
yeah. So you would need to, if you were to go and view one of these immersive experiences, like let's say traveling through a beehive, you would need the actual VR headset in order to really appreciate the video itself.
Yeah, it's definitely the highest degree of appreciation with that and immersion and experience. But with a phone that you can also turn around the 360 space, you know, most phones are able to do that now. That's also a really cool experience. Once you realize that your video isn't stuck in the frame anymore and you can look up and you can see the moon or the stars, you can look down, you can see the dirt, but just by moving your phone, that's also a really cool thing to try that most people don't even realize their phones can do.
No, I'm finding all sorts of features on this freaking huge ass iPhone 11 Max that I have. And I bought the Max, don't laugh. I bought it because I like to read Kindle books on my phone. And I have no clue about any of the other features on this phone, aside from it's a large enough screen for me to get through a book on an airplane without having to travel with two devices, my Kindle and my phone simultaneously. So I should probably dig into some of the features of this or take some kind of an iPhone 11 course to learn about this supercomputer I carry in my pocket and probably significantly underutilize. I want to talk about poetry. And I'm sure I just probably put half of our audience to sleep as soon as I mentioned the word poetry on a largely fitness based podcast. However, I am very, very curious about what inspired you to write a book called Designer Babies Still Get Scabies, this book of poetry. What got you into poetry?
Well, it's a way for me of venting frustration often and a way of capturing memories. When I was just a kid, I was just enchanted by music and it swallowed me up. And at the time I also kind of rubbed shoulders with and had the opportunity to learn from some incredible teachers, more in like, you know, the English department. They were some of my favorite teachers who also did creative writing and what have you. So I started writing songs and poetry way back when I was probably 10 or 11. And I'll do it in cycles. You know, sometimes I wake up and a bunch of stuff comes out and a lot of it is, Here's what I realized, Ben, is that if you can wrap an idea up and rhyme it, especially rhyme it in a little bit of a clever way, then you can get away with saying almost anything. If you're willing to make a line, and there's a lot of risk here, mm-hmm. but if you're willing to make a line somewhat creatively oriented or make it show up as if it is art, then it's accepted by people in a different way. So you and I speaking on this podcast or on mine, I do a lot of self-censoring because I realize that there are families watching with their children and mm-hmm. there are people who have different political beliefs and there are people who come from different backgrounds. Right. All of it.
Which is, not to rabbit hole too much, that's actually difficult for me because, I am, and a lot of my audience knows, I am a conservative libertarian Christian who lives on the border mm-hmm. of North Idaho. There are, based on that, as you can imagine, a variety of topics, from vaccination to religion to my really true, open, honest feelings on this pandemic that we're living through and yep. beyond, that I'm careful not to voice too dramatically on my show or too forcefully on my show, not because of fear per se, but mm-hmm. because when I see the amount of vitriol and divisiveness that occurs if I get close to yep. those borders, I realize that the amount of good that I can do helping people learn about, the spiritual disciplines such as gratitude and meditation and connection with family, being outdoors, nature therapy, fitness, caring for one's body, preparing amazing meals, etc. All of that, I think, helps deliver a lot of value into people's lives. And mm-hmm. if I turn myself into an extremely divisive, whatever, like an Alex Jones X character, on my podcast, sure, I might be able to get some, get some wheels spinning in people's heads in other directions, but that's not, I guess the best way I can describe it is that's not a hill I want to die on.
Yes, exactly. So if you do have a hill that you might want to die on, then it's not always best to shout that to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. It's not always best, like all of these different media are used in different ways, right? And so if you put something in a song, people might listen to the lyrics. Their subconscious will. Subliminally, you'll get access to their brain and that sort of thing. But if you really want to get someone head on, there's a different way to approach all this. So I think with poetry, one of the reasons I chose that is because it is unpopular. Because if you look at the title of my book and the cover of it is like, if that book is not for you, you're never going to buy it. You're never going to read it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And some of the poetry is kind of oriented like that, where if it's not for you, you're going to know it pretty quick. But if you do have an open mind and you have some sort of appreciation for song, satire, poetry, or even just kind of like a group creation, this is something that our grandmother, who recently passed at 97, really passed down to us in the family. She had a whole bunch of kids, raised them on a farm. And it wasn't unusual for people to, a few times a year at weddings, at funerals, at parties, for us to write silly little rhymes for each other, to write little bits of poetry, to play bluegrass songs and folk songs and sing them for our grandmother. This was very, very normal and, in fact, important to all of our health and bonding and community. And so realizing that a lot of people kind of don't have that experience, I want to push that forward and also challenge other people out there who may feel like I did, painted into a corner for me kind of in health, in that world. And a lot of people, I'm sure you go through this, Ben, too. They want you to just be this one thing and mm-hmm. only say these certain things and never say anything that ruffles feathers or what maybe you truly believe deep down. And so that's just a wonderful place to for me, especially in 2018, 2019, censorship, shadow banning, lots of people in power saying things I totally disagree with, just so much frustration, channeling that into something creative and hopefully even getting some smiles on people's faces or making them giggle a little bit is just the best use of that energy in my mind.
Yeah. In my opinion, in reading your book, the poetry book specifically, it seems like there's a lot of bitterness and an almost like angst kind of woven into it, you know, like, you know, fair. And a lot of it is short, you know, like your poem. I'm going to open up the book now. So there's one called "The President Doesn't. We all pay taxes. The President doesn't. We thought it was democracy, but it wasn't." Boom. That's the whole poem. Or another one is "The Fed. We did not vote for the Federal Reserve. Where did these crooks ever get the nerve to print our money and tweak the yield curve? Time to take back what we deserve." Like those are things that if you said them at a dinner party and they weren't, as you've so astutely noted, in poetry format, would probably start some pretty heated arguments and might even when in the format of poetic lyrics. So I'm curious, did you go through some kind of, I guess, a triggering event that would cause you to have some kind of a desire to stick it to the man, so to speak, in terms of calling out? I mean, in this book, you call it America as the plunderful, you call it the elites, you call it the president, you call it the feds. Talk about microchips and how you're nervous about that. Was there anything that happened to you before writing this book that built up some kind of angst?
Yeah, I think the leadership vacuum. You know, I'm sure you're like this too, Ben, where you're looking around and it's like, all right, who's got it dialed in? Who's doing something cool? Who's saying something interesting? And I don't want to make this political, but the transition kind of from,
you know,
like
what? The fact that we're talking about this means we're gonna have to be mildly political, I think.
Exactly. But, you know, just if we only look at, like, politics aside, if we only look at people as public speakers and communicators, that is worse now than it used to be. You know, and it doesn't matter Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, anything in between. It feels worse now than it's ever felt. And I started feeling that in, you know, well, being on the reality TV show was interesting because when you start working with big companies in media, you realize
And to interrupt you real quick, I didn't mention that in my introduction for you, but you were one of the winning personal trainers on a very popular health and fitness TV show. What was it called?
My Diet is Better Than Yours.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So being on that was very interesting. And my wife was on a reality show before that years ago and kind of coached me. And she's just like, listen, they're going to put you in a room and not feed you food and pit you against each other and try to trick you and do all this stuff. And then try to make you look like an idiot on national television, lining you up for character assassination on day one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I experienced the same when I was on the Spartan reality TV show for two years, Steve Austin's Broken Skull Challenge and a variety of other kind of more competitive TV shows. It's, you know, the 5 minutes that you see is a full day of filming.
Yep.
They are often taking a facial expression or emotion that you make in one scenario and then copying and pasting that into an entirely different scenario.
Exactly.
They are, even prior to filming, you know, in one case, you know, for the Stone Cold Steve Austin show, I had to go into a special area, get mic'd up, make a bunch of different sounds that they wanted me to make, and then they would, during the competition, then take and copy and paste those sounds that I was making and dub them over whatever was actually occurring during the show. And they essentially make up fantasy stories using clips that they string together. And I don't think every show is like that, but a lot of these reality fitness TV shows, what you're seeing is not typically what's actually occurring in the background.
That's exactly right. And that's such a subtle and weird point that a lot of people don't really understand until they look into it some. But trust us, guys, this is how TV is made. This is not how podcasts are made. That's why I love podcasts as a medium, because it's basically just long form conversation. If you want to chop it up, you can, but we hardly ever do.
We're not doing the whole NPR. We could.
No.
Why don't you make a little music and then I'll transition us into a different room and we'll Yeah, no, but you're right. Yeah. And now Abel and I meet up a year later. Abel, it's a year later. How you doing? These long form podcast conversations, they are brutally honest and open. And I agree. People crave that kind of transparency these days.
Yeah. And so I think it was partially feeling for me, to get back to your original question there, like I was slightly pigeonholed, completely overworked. They tried to exploit us, but it didn't work. But that took like all the energy we had for a while. And for the first year, really, we did well financially. and were able to pay ourselves that year, and took a little bit of time to reevaluate where we wanted to go with everything, and even be like, do we still want to do the podcast? Do we still want to be writing books? Where do we want to go? And we literally moved from Austin to Colorado our whole lives. And we've kind of been living on the road for a long time, but that was a big, big move for us, because we had to find reliable internet, a community we want to settle down in, and, you know, kind of the perfect situation in the mountains, which thankfully, after, you know, all these years, we have found, but we're still partially in boxes. You know, we've been kind of a mess for a while. And I think it's like, so while all this was happening, I realized it was becoming more and more important to really exercise all those different parts of who you are and what you want to create, whether or not it's going to be profitable or going to make you more famous or get you ahead in your career or whatever. We had a minute to decide, not very long, like months really, just to kind of like take a step back, unplug, spend no time on social media, like not have any interference there, spend lots of time in the woods, and really focus on doubling down on our spiritual work, which is one of the hidden things that happens in our lives that both my wife and I and our families have been into for a long time. I know your family as well, Ben, I'm sure in slightly different ways, but that's something that we really, when we disappear, we're spending a lot of time on that.
You did disappear for a while. I got a little worried, and this was after the TV show. Admittedly, I was like, dude, did the TV show just burn him out? And because I didn't see you as much at conferences or even in the limelight, so to speak. And I just assumed when you moved to Colorado, you kind of got a little bit more into your music. And then when this poetry book arrived, you know, I thought, well, maybe he just kind of shifted into a lot more poetry. But it sounds like for you, part of this was just needing an escape after having gone through the corpocracy of what, you know, something like being on a fitness TV show created.
Yeah, I think that's really accurate and fair. And we've done it before. You know, we did it back in like when the podcast was really big back in the early 2010s. I took some time off with Allison. We moved around and all of that. So we've done it before. But this time it did feel different, I think, because we moved. And another aspect of all this was, you know, it was cool going to those biohacking conferences, ancestral health conferences, paleo effects, when there are 50, 100 people there, right? A totally different dynamic than when they throw us up on stage in front of thousands of people and we're all mobbed, so mobbed that we can't, you know, like you and I, Rob Wolf, Mark Sisson.
Yeah, it got kind of crazy. And I, you know, obviously Paleo FX didn't happen this year, but it got really weird. Like it went from being able to attend this small event with a small number of speakers, relatively didactic format, some cool people on the expo floor, you know, showing off their samples, et cetera, to where I would show up to Paleo FX and couldn't walk through the hallway without, I'm not saying this to sound narcissistic.
It's true. But, I've been there. I've experienced it. I've seen it.
Yeah. Mobbed by people, unable to speak to any, but people literally getting in your face, like throwing their arm around you to do a selfie without you even, you know, agreeing to do something like that. Or literally just like shoving you into a corner and be like, look, I have this growth on my arm. I really got to biohack this growth on my arm. I need you to help me right now. And I also want you to sign these four books. And yeah, it got kind of weird for me too.
Yeah. So there was that dynamic too, where we just felt like, let's go to some national parks. Let's really figure out where we want to live and settle down and spend some time doing this, because it doesn't feel right now going out and being this public and this, like, the thing that happens, and I understand how and why, especially now that I've kind of been on both sides of this. Nothing against the people who are coming up to us. That's wonderful stuff, and we really appreciate it. But as a human being, especially like once you're on TV and you get that mobbed thing, it does something to you and you're dehumanized, or you feel dehumanized. And that's a really weird dynamic, and one that we all have to grapple with if we don't want it to destroy us.
Yeah. And you talked about the spiritual work and how when you went into the mountains and kind of took a break for a while that you did a lot more of the spiritual work. What does spiritual work look like for you?
Oh, I love that question. It's not as organized as probably for some other people, in the sense that it's not we don't identify with a particular church. But my wife was raised Mormon. I was raised Protestant. And there are many things that we keep in practice from Christianity. Certainly not all of it, but there are a lot of things there. So definitely Western influences, but a lot of Eastern and indigenous influences as well. And so one of the things that I got really into here in Colorado and traveling around Utah is, why are all these trees so clearly manipulated by humans? Like, what happened here? There are arbor glyphs all over, and you can see that some of the trees, pieces of the cambium layer of the bark were harvested. You can see other ones were kind of like decorated in swirls hundreds of years ago, but these trees are still around because some of them live for 600 plus years. And it turns out a lot of these are medicine trees from the Ute tribe, and spirit-based trees, shamanic trees. Some of them were built or created and manipulated over many decades to tell spiritual stories, many of them now lost to time. But spiritual study for us is the study of symbolism and meaning more than anything else, which sounds pretty obtuse. It's not necessarily a traditional Western way of looking at it, but it's one of the reasons that the poetry book came out the way that it did, and my songs and my words come out the way that they do, because when you study the symbolism behind even like what an eagle means, or a coyote, or a raven to indigenous tribes, sometimes those meanings are consistent across the world, and sometimes the way that they did things, but certainly the way that they worshiped the stars and kept track of the stars. So it's also brought us to kind of this expansive research of the world, where we came from, why we're here, what the universe is up to, which sometimes clashes with the traditional media narrative of climate change and, you know, what governments want to do in the future compared to kind of where we're going as consciousness, as humanity, all these things. It gets pretty meta and difficult to talk about in English. But I think when you look at what some of these things mean and really study the history of symbols, a lot is revealed about what the media and what politicians are trying to do to us. It becomes more clear what direction they're trying to pull us in. And I don't believe it's a good one.
How would one be able to actually learn more about how to study that type of symbology? Were there certain books that you relied upon, for example?
Yes, so many books. We looked into kind of ancestral health, indigenous leaning books. There are some like medicine cards, medicine wheels. There are so many books written about that. Even just looking into
that's not the name of the book, Medicine Cards. That you look for a book about medicine cards or about medicine wheels.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some of the books are upstairs. I'd be happy to send you a link to a few.
Me a list, if you remember to at some point after this podcast, if you send me a list, because what I can do is put those in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies if people want to learn a little bit more about that symbology, just because, you know, I'm supremely curious about that myself. You know, a cow moose wandered into our yard a few days ago, and I have not seen a moose in 6 years here. And I said to Jessa, well, that I think is interesting. I'd like to look into the symbology of meese or moose or however you say it. And, you know, we learned about how it indicates a foreshadowing and forethought and planning, and that would be a good time to actually sit down and assess, you know, plans for one's life or plans for the future. And I find those type of things incredibly interesting and would love to learn more, but really haven't sat down and found a good place to start book-wise.
Yeah, I'll send you a couple. There are some excellent ones. Sometimes just looking at ancient decks of cards and ancient art will reveal a lot of the study of symbols as well. But I would say try to look into the history of wherever you live and what the beliefs are and were of the people who lived there for thousands of years before we did, because it seems to me that much of this history has been kind of covered up or not taught to us on purpose. And we're taught to believe, or at least think in some way or feel in some way, that there are these idiot barbarians who knew nothing of the world and were just savages. And we replaced them because they didn't deserve to be here. And that could not be further from the truth. From what, you know, the research that I've done and some of their spiritual beliefs, that could not be further from the truth.
Interesting. Yeah. And you know, I was recently actually reading an article about that, about how early humans actually settled in America. And apparently it was like twice as long ago as we actually thought. And of course, the idea is that it was still a land bridge linking from Siberia to Alaska where the crossover occurred. But apparently, you know, Americans or human beings have been in America for a very long period of time, or at least a lot longer than we have thought that they were. So, This is all so funny because my kids and I were chatting last night at the dinner table about the celebration of Christopher Columbus and Columbus Day and how how interesting it is that we celebrate someone who actually resulted in a lot of abuse to humans when he arrived in the Americas, and yet at the same time, you know, discovered the new land. And how do we approach that topic of people who have done great things in the past, but who are also may have been a little bit effed up themselves? You know, how do we laud them and you know, commit the great things that they've done to memory while at the still at the same time acknowledging that maybe they weren't, you know, perfect people?
We're indoctrinated to think that the world is binary, that people are good or bad. But especially when you look at history, we could never understand the context. There were good things and there were bad things. And it shouldn't be like, leave the racist statue there or tear it down forever. Those don't have to be the only options, right? It's important that we recognize the nuance here and also learn from our history before we repeat it. And also it's very important to realize that what we're taught in schools and what we get from our education is very self-selective, or it's got giant blind spots. And it's really on us to work on our weak spots and go exploring for those wacky things. Yeah. And Ben, you're a great example of that. You do the work, you do the research, and you have that curiosity. Probably a lot of it came from being homeschooled or like kind of just being more independent minded. And me as well, I wasn't homeschooled, but I had a lot of independent studies and great teachers coming up. And if I hadn't, I'm not sure that I would have that intellectual curiosity, but that's really what you need and what you need to nurture in yourself and in your kids to really keep learning about all of this.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And just one more thing on the symbology thing. If you think it doesn't matter, look at a dollar bill and tell me again that it doesn't matter because there are symbols used by almost every large institution out there, and they do have meaning. And when you look into what that meaning is supposed to be, it becomes a lot more interesting.
Yeah, the dollar bill symbology alone, that's super interesting. And I think a lot of people don't realize, I don't even remember all the, it's like the sunrise and the eagle. And I'm off the top of my head, I don't remember all the symbols on the dollar bill. But you are right, it's built into our culture pretty significantly. So send me some of those books, and I'll put a link to them in the show notes. You know, just a couple other things, and I also want to ask you about this wild diet approach that you have, because it's been a long time since we've talked about that. But before we jump off the political bandwagon, I'm curious, for you as a health influencer, if you've had to deal with a lot of the same censorship that a lot of the rest of us have had to deal with lately. You know, there are some, you know, big folks like, you know, Dr. Mercola is one of the first guys who come to mind, who has been heavily censored by Google, by Facebook, by YouTube. Another friend of mine who runs a podcast called London Real, he recently interviewed David Icke and got pulled off of YouTube for, or is it David Icke, David Icke, however you pronounce Icke, that. Yeah. But yeah, for some of the inflammatory rhetoric there regarding, I believe, 5G and coronavirus and vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And it's been very interesting seeing how Google search engine results have dramatically changed over the past 2 years, in that most of the results that you get when you pull them up are results from primarily websites that are fed by ads that are driven by, for example, revenue going to pharmaceutical companies, for example, or a complete absence of alternative health remedies or alternative cancer remedies. And honestly, if you want to do a bit of home hippie alternative health remedy, you know, whatever, my kid has a scar, but I don't necessarily, you know, want to, whatever, buy glue sutures on Amazon. I want to know if there's some kind of an essential oil that might help this to heal better. You literally have to go to like the third page of the search results on Google to find what you're looking for now, or use a different search engine like DuckDuckGo or Quant. And, you know, I haven't had a whole lot of my articles censored because most of my stuff is about whatever, bench pressing or running faster, your abs. But, you know, I've seen a lot of people get hit pretty hard by this. And I'm curious how you've experienced that on your end.
Dude, we got crushed. Really? Because our whole business this whole time has been built around organic traffic, doing things the right way in a meritocracy where you build a reputation and wonderful backlinks and good content that licks to itself, and you practice good, you know, SEO hygiene and whatever on your site, and you know, stay on top of your websites, you deliver the truth, and you link to studies when appropriate and all the rest of it. Yeah. So in 2016 or 17, the Wild Diet was the number 7 diet in America on Google. And our traffic was in the multi-millions. And then they turned it off. Like 90% of it is all gone. And in fact, to the point where and also on the social media accounts,
wow,
2 years ago, none of them have grown. Each one has like 40, 50,000 or something like that. They have all lost followers ever since, despite putting out many, many shows and continuing to put out our content. And then, I mean, the censorship was so bad that I didn't even realize that Rob Wolf had disappeared from all my social channels. Like, he was talking about shadow banning, censorship, and all this stuff really hard. He shut down his podcast. I had no idea, even though I follow him everywhere, because he was buried and I couldn't find them. So I've had dozens, maybe hundreds of people over the past year or two being like, hey, are you still doing your podcast? Are you still like doing anything? And I'm like, oh, you mean the like 100 plus shows I've been putting out the past couple of years? Yes, yes, wow, we're still doing it.
Wow.
But we're that buried. And so I don't know exactly, like, we didn't get a memo. They didn't tell us this is going to happen or why, but it's not a good sign. And it's one of the reasons that I started to do the more artistic stuff too, because it's like, if you're getting no benefit from, you know, putting out and writing more articles about those very important things right now, like, we could be writing about very important things, but if no one's going to see them, then you've got to readjust and focus on doing some other work. So it's been really an adjustment for us, because taking away all of the organic traffic for us, like when someone types in our name and then mm-hmm. we're connected to them, if you take that away, now all of a sudden we've got to pay for it. We've got to like pay Facebook or pay some other company to get access to our own community of subscribers who don't otherwise see any of our stuff. So we have to lose money and pay our enemies in order to keep going. And that's a spiritual adjustment, you know? Like,
yeah.
I've realized how upside down this world is more and more in the past couple of years. And there's always a way through. There's always a way to adapt, but you have to honor that you have to adapt. Right. You have to honor that sometimes it's time to stop doing things.
A lot of folks are shifting to, for example, you know, DuckDuckGo or Quant are shifting their browser yep. from Chrome to a different browser such as Brave. Many, of course, are getting off of social media. It's very interesting. You know, you even see a guy like Joe Rogan, for example, make a shift from YouTube yep. over to Spotify. And I've wondered whether or not, you know, he's also seen some of the writing on the wall in terms of, you know, some of the potential for the guests that he has producing inflammatory enough content to where his channel could get banned on YouTube.
For sure.
And so, yeah, I think it's an increasingly concerning issue. And yeah, that's sad to hear how much it affected you and your business. I mean, I heard a lot of other people who literally went from a very, very high search engine rankings and doing quite well in their business to completely getting shut down by Google's yep. active censorship.
And they don't say why, but the flat earthers are fine. Mm-hmm. All those people out there saying yeah. that the earth is flat, like, they're not going after some really ludicrous and ridiculous things. They're going after us first. And so this is not played out yet. You know what I mean? Like, that's a really bad sign for what's coming next. But I will say, from the top down anyway, that's a bad sign. But I will say, right now we live in a centralized internet, right, where YouTube and Facebook and these centralized giant companies need to spend all this money on server farms and all this staff to run all this stuff. But in the background brewing, there are other technologies and alternatives and really pissed off thinking people right now who are building it, a decentralized way to get our information and content out there based on the blockchain, perhaps, like Theta is a really promising technology that I've geeked out on for the past few months. But basically, if you can build a decentralized internet where we're serving, our computers are sharing resources, uploading and downloading, serving video and other content to each other, then it cannot be censored from the top down, no yeah. matter what they think. And yeah. that's a double-edged sword. I'm not saying that that's, you know, going to solve all of our problems, but it certainly will hopefully bring back a little bit of the meritocracy to this, because whoever is setting the rules right now and picking the winners, it's shady. It's yeah. super shady. And like, I looked for your Wikipedia page before this, Ben, and I couldn't find it. Mine's been deleted. Vinny Tortorich's has been deleted.
Yeah, I think I did have a Wikipedia page for a while. I don't really monitor that too much, but you couldn't
it's
find
not
it
there
right?
anymore. Just interesting. Like mine.
Huh? Yeah. That's interesting. Now I'm gonna have to look for my Wikipedia page after this podcast. You've got me all
See,
nervous.
You can find us on Greatest. Yeah. Right. Can't find. There
really, we were both on Greatest in the world's 100 most influential health and fitness people, and we're not there anymore.
Try to look us up.
Wow,
it's so like when that's been really interesting to me. I'm like, where exactly have we been scrubbed from, and who's been put there instead? Because the Kardashians are on that influential page. I don't remember them being there on the same page as us.
Interesting. Well, I mean, big picture for our audience is just be careful. You know, as you're using Google, YouTube, etc., the results that you get are not necessarily unbiased results spat out by an AI search engine, but are now being, to a certain extent, censored by a human being or a group of human beings. And it's a little bit concerning. So,
and co-opted too, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think a lot of us thinking people, we see this happening right now, and we're aware that at least to some degree we're in this environment, and that's going to be okay. You know, that's going to be all right. Cause you're doing this not for the money. Fantastically interested in like all these things. And you're a nerd like me, you love reading the books and doing the research, and they're not going to get rid of us. Even if people can't find us, they won't forget about us. Because we've been doing the work for so long, and
And if you do forget about us, look out, world, because then all of a sudden we'll hit you with a book like Designer Baby Still Gets Scabies, 3 years after you haven't heard anything from us, and all of a sudden make some waves. All right. Well, Abel, you also, of course, have this book, The Wild Diet, that we've alluded to a few times. And we did a podcast before on it. And I'll link to that podcast in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies. But I would love to hear an update. I'm curious for you. I love practical examples for you living out in Colorado, having learned everything that you learned about, eating, on the wild side, so to speak, or following this wild diet. What it kind of looks like for you right now, the way that you're fueling your body.
Yeah, I've been surprised by how much I haven't changed the way that I really think about a lot of this. But in practice, sometimes it shows up differently now than it would have about 10 years ago when I put a lot of this together. And so back then I was in my mid-20s and I wanted to eat a lot. I had a massive hunger that I do not have anymore. I think that that's kind of interesting, and I see eating less, especially for longevity, certainly body composition and other things like that, as long as you're recovering appropriately, I see eating less as a big win. I see it as a step in making your metabolism a little bit more efficient. And so when I do my training, my main run that I do once or twice a week, we start at 8,000 feet where we live up in the mountains, and I run up the mountain, do hill sprints up to 10,000 feet, and then 5-7 miles later come back down. And I don't bring any water. I don't have any food that day. I usually do it around 3 or 4 p.m. And 10 years ago, I would have laughed at that. That would have been ridiculous. How could you ever suffer through that sort of experience? But after really focusing on intermittent fasting, fueling with clean fats, I don't know what exactly there are different words for those fats now than there used to be, different people listening. But anyway, the natural fats, the ones that are stable, that aren't rancid, that aren't going to kill you, focusing on that, always paying attention to protein. Sometimes I'm surprised by how hungry I get when I forget to kind of reach that threshold of protein for the day. Mm-hmm. I would say one thing that has really changed for me in the past 5 or 10 years is I was very skeptical of supplements 10, 5 years. I'm still very skeptical, but I was skeptical of all supplements kind of, the longer back you go. And certainly when you look at the deficiency in vitamin D, the deficiency in zinc and vitamin C, most people are deficient in most things. When you look around, you really test it, including people in health. And so for me, with the lockdowns with my wife, it's been harder to get fresh veg too. That's another piece. And so I've found that if I dial the supplementation in, then my hunger goes way down. I'm not craving as much nasty food. I don't want to eat as much. We still eat quite luxuriously, But generally speaking, it's one meal in the evenings, maybe a small half meal before that or after that. Lots of bone broth, eating nose to tail is something that I think a lot of people have kind of missed or they didn't get fully into back in the ancestral health craze. And then they skipped over it with the keto. And now carnivore is kind of bringing that back, which is good. If you're eating nose to tail, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
And then it's really the supplementation of greens and other powdered shelf stable things like collagen protein was not largely available 5 or 10 years ago. There was like Great Lakes and a few others doing gelatins and things like that. But now there are some really wonderful, more on the prepared food side, on the supplements that are shelf stable side, greens, proteins, and various things like that, that I think make this lifestyle a lot more achievable for the people who aren't as into it as us. So I think that's really promising.
Yeah. And frankly, my take on the whole, I guess, micronutrient deficiency status or need for supplementation comes down to the fact that, A, not only are we living in a post-industrial era where we do have things like, you know, monocropping of wheat, soy, and corn that has depleted the soil of many minerals and nutrients, in addition to a wide range of toxins and pollutants that have increased our need for support for our antioxidants or our methylation or our detoxification pathways, et cetera. But that aside, if you look at human history, humans have always supplemented, and so have animals, on everything from oils to tinctures to leaves to roots to even plant medicines, literally, since the dawn of time. The fact that we now have encapsulation technology that allows us to put that into bottles doesn't make it any different. If you were to test a human being 500 years ago, if that technology were available, we would have seen deficiencies in vitamin A or deficiencies in vitamin D or pre-type 2 diabetes or any other number of factors that we're simply able to identify now. But, you know, the supplementation then was different. It was a little bit more intuitive and a little bit more, based on folklore and what had been passed down from generation to generation. And now it's more based on lab results and research. But I don't think that supplementation is something that is new for humankind. I think it's something that we've been doing for a long time. It's just more convenient now, honestly.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. And certainly fermented cod liver oil and things like that, the tinctures, using roots and herbs. This is really how I got into a lot of this, is because when my origin story or backstory was, I got really sick when I was an infant and had a temperature for many days that we could not kick. And so they pumped me full of all sorts of antibiotics, which I'm still allergic to this day. So I can't take them. So my mom, who was a nurse at the time, went deep into research about herbs, holistic medicine, alternative health, and became an author and speaker herself and raised us with these smelly tinctures and balms and all that. So that's really where we're coming from. And I hated it growing up because it made us so weird, and I rebelled against it, and I just love it more than anything now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And by the way, I whipped out my phone a couple of minutes ago and I did Google Ben Greenfield Wikipedia and Ben Greenfield Greatest. And you're right. Neither of those websites exist anymore. That is super interesting.
I feel like you should have a Wikipedia page at this point, don't you? I mean, like,
well, that's the thing is, I feel like at some point I did. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure you did. All right. Vinny did, and we did. I haven't even looked at how many people this has happened to. I just figured I'd look before.
That's interesting. Right. Congratulations on getting me to actually take out my phone during a podcast and Google myself. It has been quite some time since I've pulled off that chump move. Okay, so the other thing that I wanted to kind of get into were a few of your recipes, one in particular that you have in this book that I think would be perfect icing on the cake, so to speak, for today's show. And that is the choco nut cookie recipe. The choco nut cookie recipe looks fantastic. Just to give people a little bit of a flavor, pun intended, of how you can eat healthy and have it taste amazing, because my kids made a variation of this. They didn't use there was one ingredient on here that they subbed. Trying to find it. It was the coconut palm sugar. I think they may have even used Swerve for this one.
Yeah, you see,
but super chewy, good cookies. Like, and I like my cookies chewy. So what is the way? And you have multiple cookie recipes, so I'd imagine you guys make cookies. So just sure. fill the audience in on the wild approach to cookies.
Yeah, it's part of the deal, you know, because I think there's this whole people throw this at you, they throw it at me, that they think that we're fitness bunnies and we're only eating cardboard and lettuce. No. And if you're going to do this for a lifetime, especially with kids and significant others and loved ones, you're going to have to find a way to make it fun. So if you're making your food, even if it's cookies, with real food ingredients, then you can get away with almost anything because, you know how much sugar's in there. The kids know how much sugar they're throwing into those things. And for me growing up, one of my best friends, we were captains of the basketball team together. We would, on the weekends, we'd make pancakes together, like from scratch, and just throw a bunch of stuff in there and like find out what happens when you have too much vanilla or too much sugar or not enough flour and all the rest of it, or when you don't put an egg in or you do. And so our approach is really, we love it when people sub ingredients, but we kind of have these cookies or breads or even pizzas and tacos and other crazy stuff like that, that we encourage people to make, despite the fact that most people are trying to be healthy, lose weight, or work on their body composition. And we're here to say that there's a way that you can do that. And your kids are a great example of, you get in the kitchen, you mm-hmm. take a few of these ingredients. Sometimes you start with a recipe, but a lot of times we don't. We just kind of improv. And that's where the fun is. That's where, because you don't always have the ingredients that are in the recipe. Who has coconut palm sugar? That's one of the reasons we put it in there, was kind of just like, we want people to sub. We want them to not have that and be like, what am I going to put in? And if you do, coconut palm sugar is a lovely tasting ingredient, and it is kind of unique in its own way, as is honey and molasses, the blackstrap variety, and maple sugar and maple syrup. And you can use any one of those that you'd like, but you have to, there's no free lunch. You know how much sugar's in it. You know the carbs, and you've got a feel for all that. And then at the same time, it is a cookie, right? So even if we make our own pizza, we're not going to crush the whole thing, or a sourdough bread or whatever. Sometimes I'll crush half. maybe. Sometimes I'll crush half, but usually here's a big thing that happens when you make food, especially with your family at home. There's a big difference between like grabbing a pizza or big thing of sourdough from the store and crushing through it, compared to having made that with your hands, with your family. You're not just going to eat everyone else's pizza before they do, right? Because like you all made it together. Suddenly this is, a spiritual moment. It's a moment of sharing and creation and gratitude. And it's by kind of getting your hands dirty, I think, especially as a community and as a family, that you start to realize how important all of this is. And then you start to perhaps eat your cookies in a better mindset, instead of being stressed while you're eating them and all just like, I need a little sugar boost right now. You're just like, you take a step back, you take a deep breath, and you're like, this is a damn good cookie.
Yep. And this one is just shredded unsweetened coconut palm sugar, sea salt, coconut oil, vanilla extract, eggs, dark chocolate chips, and walnut pieces. That's so simple. Easy. And I mean, when you know that you can eat the cookie dough pretty guilt-free, you know it's a good cookie. You'll get a
especially
kick out of this.
Especially when it's cold. Man, you freeze that dough.
Oh, my gosh. Did you know my kids have a cooking podcast?
Yeah, I did know that. They've had that for a while, right?
Yeah, they've had it for 2 years. It's the Go Greenfield show. And so I'm going to give you a little preview of what tonight's dinner is. Because because on Fridays, they do a lot of their food prep for their episode. So they're doing an episode on unconventional ingredients. And our dinner tonight is chicken liver ravioli.
Wow.
Chocolate chip cookies made with cricket protein powder. But they actually got the crickets and made the cricket protein powder themselves. So this isn't like store-bought cricket protein powder. And then wild plant pesto from the wild nettle, the wild mint, the dandelions, et cetera, growing around our house. But instead of olive oil, they're using camel hump fat in the pesto. So that is our dinner, is liver ravioli, camel hump fat pesto, and cricket powdered protein chocolate chip cookies.
Your kids are the best. Yeah. That is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we certainly are into the wild stuff here at the Greenfield House too, when it comes to the wild food prep methods. So this book, Designer Babies Still Get Scabies, that one people can get on Amazon, right?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Wild Diet as well?
Yes. Perfect. That on Amazon. It's getting harder to search for us, but you'll find us eventually.
That's okay. And sad, actually. But then for you guys listening in, guys and gals, what I'm going to do is Abel's going to send me some of his resources on Symbology. I'm not going to let you forget, Abel. And I'm going to put those in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies. I'm going to link to my previous episode that I did with Abel. And if I'm super googly woogly today, which it seems like I am, I'm going to hunt down our Udemy course. And what the heck, just for old time's sake, I'll put a link to our old school Udemy biohacking course, one of the originals with me and Abel, that you can find in the show notes as well. That's all going to be at bengreenfieldfitness.com/designerbabies. I could actually talk to Abel for a very long time because we probably got into like 1/10 of the stories that he has and the kind of stuff that we would love to riff on. But alas, time has slipped away. And so, Abel, we're just going to have a round three at some point.
Hey, let's plan on it. And you're going to come back on my show. And anyone listening, Ben has a recent episode coming out with this school year that I think is going to be really appropriate, especially for those of us trapped at home with kids.
Awesome. I love it. And I'm going to have to go see if that Udemy course got scraped or not. We'll see. I don't know. I'm going to blame it on you if it did, though.
It's definitely my fault.
All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening in. And I'm Ben Greenfield along with Abel James signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have an amazing week. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.